Hey, this is Richard Stuverud, and this is State of Love and Trust.
Welcome, everyone, to another episode of The State of Love and Trust. It's a Pearl Jam podcast, and I'm one of your two hosts, Jason Carapesi, and alongside me, as always, is...
Paul Guillieri.
Okay, Paul, we've got a hell of a guest on tap today on this episode. Before we get to that guest, anybody who's watching on YouTube, please go ahead and subscribe, hit the bell, like the video. Helps other music fans, Pearl Jam fans, find this content. That would be super helpful. But if you're still old school, like OG State of Love and Trust podcast, and you like to listen to the audio only, Paul, what are they doing?
You can rip off that cellophane by ripping off. Oh, God, let me try that again.
here he goes again. Take two.
Here we go again. We can rip off that cellophane by rating, reviewing, and subscribing on your preferred podcast platform of choice. Feed that algorithm. It keeps the lights on. It keeps you happy. It keeps us happy. But more importantly, it just keeps the communication flow.
That's right. And Apple made a change in the last few months where if you do write a review, that helps the algorithm boost the show in front of more people's eyes. And, you know what? I'm gonna help that.
It's alive.
Because we need like a little teaser. We need a little reward for doing so. We're gonna choose a review over, let's say, the next couple of weeks, 2-3 weeks. All Our right. favorite review will get this. This is a copy
would
of
you look at that?
Mojo. I'm holding it up, but we're gonna put it on screen.
Is that the article with the that is the article? Oh, yeah.
This is the article. So, you know, there it is. Right there. And, oh, by the way, it has the bonus CD. The CD, not a vinyl. There it is, right there. So that could be yours if we choose your review. So write a review. It could be one word. It could be 48 words. I don't know. Whatever you want. But that's a little, you know, token of our appreciation.
I
kind of
want that for my own little display.
Paul
cabinet.
Does not have
I am
access
not eligible.
To this contest.
I am not eligible.
Ineligible. By the way, if you like what we do here, and you want more of it, there is a place to do that. It is Patreon. The link is right here. We just did a giveaway in March. That giveaway was for this, the Dark Metal. I did that last time. Dark Matter Vinyl. Why is it so hard to say? Gentleman by the name of Aris Lambropoulos out of Fairfax, Virginia, won that. So it's on its way to him now. Mm-hmm. This month in April of 2024, the Dark Matter vinyl, the whole thing, the whole damn kit and caboodle.
Yeah. A little bigger LP. This time, huh?
I can't show because I don't have it, but that'll be, you know, it's going to be coming to your doorstep if you win April's Patreon giveaway. So link is there in the bio, everywhere else, if you're interested in that, or just buying us a coffee. You don't have to do that, but, you know, if you want free stuff, that would be a way to do that. Anyways, also, we're wearing shirts. Look at this.
We are wearing shirts. It's the never-ending shill.
Never-ending shill. But they're fun. Who doesn't like fun?
They are fun. Come on. Stand of Love and Trust, Vitology era shirt.
Yeah.
And what, you got the Tivoli on, right? Is that what you got?
I do.
State of Love and Trust. Little, Tivoli.
The snake guy.
The snake guy.
Real quick before we get to our guest, Paul, I want to quiz you. You know, we had a great time talking with Kyle Meredith last episode.
You
and
did.
A lot of his content makes its way over to the Consequence website. And they recently published their top 100 bassists of all time. I'm going to ask you, what number is Jeff Ament?
Top 100 of all time. We're talking like all jazz time. Bassists, like everybody, right? 17.
Trick question. He did not make it.
Oh, you're kidding me. Top 100, he didn't make it?
Didn't make it. Thanks, right. Consequence.
Yeah, I take umbrage with this ranking.
Yeah. I'll give you a real quick. Number one was James Jamerson.
Okay.
Number two, Paul McCartney.
Well, yeah.
Yeah. Number three, Jaco Pastorius, obviously. Mm-hmm. Four, Carol Kaye. Five, Flea. Six, Geddy Lee. Seven, Bootsy Collins.
Rush.
Yeah. Eight, Steve Harris from Iron Maiden.
Okay. Makes sense.
9, Charles Mingus. 10, there's a little allusion here. Number 10, John Entwistle of The Who. Maybe we'll talk some Who later on. I don't know.
I think we shall.
Well, anyways, this week's episode.
Well, Jeff, like I said, he is number one on our list. How about that?
You know what? Number one in our hearts.
That's right.
That's all that matters. That's all that matters. Dark matters. Oh, that was terrible. Sorry. We've got a guest. He's waiting in the wings, and he's coming up next. He's played drums in countless bands, including the Fastbacks, War Babies, Fifth Angel, as well as with our friend and favorite bassist, Jeff Ament and Three Fish, Trace Mountains, and RNDM, and has 2 solo records out with a 3rd on the way. And oh, by the way, he finds time to teach at the School of Rock in Berkeley. It's Richard Stuverud.
Hey, thank you for having me.
We're thrilled to have you.
Cheers. I'm having a little evening tea.
We've all got something different here. I've got a little cerveza, probably got some vino, and you got a little tea.
Is it the chamomile leaf?
No, what you got there? I'm doing a ginger. It's just, you know, there's like throat coat and all of that, but I find that ginger.
Paul will email you his tincture recipe.
Oh, okay. Nice.
I know you're a big coffee guy in general.
Absolutely, yeah.
How do you take it? Let's start with that.
You know, I just, it's got to have a little half and half, you know. Mm-hmm. My wife takes it black. I'm going a little bit, you know, just a little bit of cream there.
Yeah. Have you tried steering away from that at all? Have you tried to convince you to go black at all or no?
No, but my goal is to eventually match Dave Grohl and his coffee intake. I heard he's...
That guy's like 5 pots a day, right?
Yeah. Well, I don't know if it's 5, but it's definitely a few, you know? Yeah, there's something about coffee and drumming. I find it not so much live, but in the studio, you know, it's a little bit... Time is a little bit stretched out, so it's like, okay, you know.
I got you.
Is Jeff a big tea and coffee guy?
He's a pretty big coffee guy.
I heard he's an iced coffee guy.
Yeah, done that. And some of our recordings in Montana, you know, he would always come back with surprises, bakery items, iced coffee.
He's a pastry boy, huh?
Yeah. He makes a mean French toast, too.
No kidding.
Yeah. Oh, nice. Yeah. Nice.
This is interesting. We'll have to get the recipe.
There was Trace, when we made the Trace Mountains record, you know, it was Jeff and Doug and I, and then Mike made it about 3 or 4 days later. And once Mike arrived, Jeff won a Saturday morning, just like, I don't know what time he got up, but it was serious, just French toast. It was just like this deluxe, deluxe.
Is he breakfast. Going like, you know, powdered sugar, like berry compo?
Yeah.
Like,
There was all of that. Yeah. It was the works, you know.
Who knew? We're getting nuggets out of the gate here, Paul.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Rich.
Oh, I was going to say he's a great cook, great chef.
Fantastic.
Well, we're going to dive a lot more into Jeff's cooking and really all of your ties to Jeff and the band. But yeah. Figured we'd start by talking about your solo work.
Oh, cool.
You know, Jason and I were actually off air talking about this a little bit, and just rediscovering some of that stuff. And
nice.
It's aging well. It's aging better than my wine is aging.
Oh, I'll tell you that much. Okay.
And, you know, we found that the records are kind of like family reunions of sorts in the way that the collaborations, you know, you have these collaborations with all kinds of friends and colleagues. And besides drumming, you know, you're really adept on the piano, and you've got this very unconventional approach to guitar, which we'll get to.
But, nice.
I guess the first question here is, you know, what instrument do you feel that you tend to gravitate towards at least the genesis of a song? So when an idea comes to you, is it mostly piano that kind of brings you to the manifestation of the tune? Is it messing around with a groove on the drums?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think like when I go all the way back to my high school years, taking piano lab. I'll never forget my teacher at the time. Everyone's reading music, and I'm actually just putting songs together. Growing up in Ballard, part of Seattle, I have this old upright piano that the family collected antiques. And so I think, like, outside of just the natural drumming, you know, the songwriting started to kind of, you know, evolve really early on. You know, I'd have like a boom box and, I don't know, put on like, you know, early Tom Petty record and figured out, you know, breakdown. And so that's always been sort of there. And I think in regards to like songwriting, you know, yeah, the piano, keyboard is definitely the go-to instrument. The funny thing about the guitar though, is like, I can only play guitar left-handed, open tuned, and it's embarrassing. I say I use these like finger chords, but many of the engineers I work with are funny. When I do these hack guitar parts, it's just to get like a basic track, and then I'll have, you know, all my favorite players come in. But you know, one thing, because I'm a drummer, it's like some engineers really notice, like, hey, your rhythm, you know. And so I'll add that to a lot of tracks to get it, you know, kind of rolling. But yeah, it's sort of, you know, piano, a little bit of that open tune guitar, and drums. I mean, you know, all the way back early on, I mean, that was just sort of like really happening. You know, I felt like, and it wasn't until I started playing with Jeff where he kind of, I don't know, some of our early jams, you know, pre Pearl Jam, you know, really get into these moments where it's like, wow, drums sound melodic. You know, I think we were getting into some like weird tribal stuff, and we were even jamming on like funk stuff, like Cameo, like just 80s. And I just remember, like, you know, okay, you know, in Mother Love Bone, I'm like, you know, in War Babies, were like these kind of rocking guys, and he'd show up and just start playing this funk stuff. And so that really kind of opened my ears and eyes as far as really branching out as a rock drummer. Like, eh, I'm going to get a little tribal. And Three Fish was a good example of that. But so, yeah, it's all kind of connected there, you know, with
people who are drummers who go to play guitar, write songs and guitar. I'm a very percussive person when it comes to what I like about music. Mm-hmm. Like my parents grew up playing like Aerosmith and like Stevie Wonder, Earth, Wind & Fire, Michael Jackson, Led Zeppelin. Like anything with a great groove is what was on the record player in the house. So when drummers pick up the guitar, I find that I really enjoy their style of guitar playing. And listen, open tuning, how many great players wrote some great songs with open tuning? I mean, Keith Richards, Open D, Stone Gossard, the list goes on and on and on, right? So
we can't all be Johnny Resnick from the Goo Goo Dolls with like 59 guitars in various tunings.
yeah, exactly.
When you have your little chord structure, or you've got a melody in your head, and you're like, okay, I know that I can only do this, that, or the other thing on the guitar, but I got this idea. How do you translate that to like an actual riff? Like, is there somebody that you say, I know so-and-so is going to hear what I'm saying to them and translate it into what I want it to be?
Oh, right, right. Well, you know, that's also a good question. What's really funny, there was an old engineer guitarist that I was working with worked in a post-production studio pretty much right before the financial crisis. There was this really high-end studio, and he would do commercials during the day, and then he'd have the keys to the studio late night. And I would get a lot of session calls and go down to Venice and just be in LA. But I'll never forget when I would get some of these sessions for various songwriters, it sort of worked out where I had time to, you know, hey, if you have a song. And so I actually started to kind of put some songs together while I'm doing drums for somebody else. But that particular engineer, you know, after writing three or four songs, matter of fact, this engineer I'm speaking of produced Stargazers and, you know, which has this really open, open sound. But I'll never forget you know, I would ask him like, hey, is this sounding like something? He goes, hey man, you know, it's all good. You know, you're writing the same song over and over again. It's awesome. You know, but it was, you know, all fun and, you know, goofing around, you know, that kind of stuck with me as well. So a lot of times I'll kind of, you know, do things, you know, kind of not necessarily repeating myself, but just finding certain chord changes that just kind of resonate. And I'll just try and, you know, kind of, you know, mess around stuff. I think like writing more from the piano though, I mean, that's where things get really interesting with the major and minor, you know.
Will you put out like a little like a melody line on the piano and say, hey, so-and-so, how would you translate this into a guitar riff? Well, I want it to chug, I want it to do this, whatever.
Well, the other weird thing, I have this weird fascination with George Harrison and the Beatles where it's that drone. So like for a brief moment, I studied tabla from an Indian master when I lived in back east. And it was just really interesting where I've always been just really attracted to that drone. So a lot of my songs will have that kind of drone element. It's like a lot of times I'll have like these melodies that might be sort of a George Harrison influence thing where the chord is just sort of droning out, but then you can kind of hit some pretty psychedelic melodies. Mm-hmm. And when I go there, it's almost like a guilty pleasure. So I feel like, you know, I'm kind of, you know, doing something that's already been done, but it feels natural to me. And I feel like that's something to, you know, follow through with, you know.
Is it safe to say Revolver is your favorite Beatles record?
Totally. Actually taught. I have a pretty good private student, you know, as well as like School of Rock, but I just taught a student today, Tomorrow Never Knows. And she was great. You know, it was just like getting the mechanics of drumming, you know, with the student. What's interesting is everything gets slowed down so that they get the mechanics, right? And man, lately it's just been incredible. It's like certain classic songs almost sound more intriguing and like, hey, it's kind of cool slowed down. Like I put the vinyl on so she could hear the original and it was super fast and like all psychedelic and she couldn't play it that fast, but it was actually cool to slow it down. And I did the whole keyboard thing. And so,
you know, I'm curious, Richard, when it comes to like this level of collaboration, kind of what the Beatles were doing, obviously, mm-hmm. and your experience as well with the many musicians that you collaborate with.
Yeah.
In some ways, you know, when you start thinking about that experience with Gigaton, you know, your debut, similar to Gigaton, mm-hmm. You guys kind of both released records right around the time that COVID hit, right? So the pandemic hits and Memories and Kodachrome comes out, Gigaton comes out.
Yeah.
You know, I think yours was in May, I think, of 2020. So very shortly after we're really getting heavy.
Yeah.
So, you know, you couldn't really get together with friends and family.
Right.
For a while, right? So was there ever any thought for you at the time of maybe delaying the release, or, you know, were you feeling at that particular time, you know, this is the first Richard Stuverud solo offering? Like
you know, what was strange about COVID was I think just being isolated, and I know many musicians, you know, have kind of said the same thing, where within that isolation, I almost feel like the cathartic element of writing sort of made sense. And then it was sort of this thing where, because things had slowed down, I think it allowed for this idea of, instead of just, you know, being super creative and then letting songs just kind of exist in the ether of, I mean, put on the shelf, you know, it was like, hey, maybe this is a time to actually just jump on this in the DIY, like just put stuff out. And once I did that, it was like, okay, now I'm addicted to that and I can't stop. I thought like, am I going to do vinyl this time around? You know? And I thought about it for a second. I'm like, hell yeah, I'm doing vinyl. I just recently put the finishing touches up with Barrett Jones at Laundry Room in Seattle, and I brought in Tim DiGiulio's amazing guitar player. And you know, I was telling Barrett, like, yeah, I'm gonna do vinyl. He's like, why? You know, and it's like, I don't know. I mean, I feel like
the cost, the inconvenience, you know.
Yeah, right, exactly. But you know, it is a vanity, you know, sort of element. But maybe it's just important that if we can find a way and we have the means to do it, you know, why not? You know,
if it makes you happy.
Yeah, right. You know.
Well, it's in service of the forum too, right? I mean, yeah. There's something nostalgic about experiencing music that way,
yeah,
as a youth.
And I'm not going to deny, you know, my own limitations with being into the whole streaming thing, and just like I know that's where we are today, and there's no denying that. But I do feel like there's nothing can touch like the actual art. And Jeff and I have talked about that a lot. He's like, there's just something about the tangible, you know, holding on to something that makes it feel more like art, and maybe not so much, you know, okay, here it is. Yeah. The way, you know, so many people are listening to music these days, you know, we have to adapt to that, but there's also something to be said, you know, I mean, my father, he wasn't a musician, but he literally like thousands of records, like while he'd paint, he was just listening to like the most obscure stuff. And I just remember that really just, you know, spoke to me, you know, on that end.
Well, as a father, your son, Alexander.
Yeah.
Sang on both your first two records.
Yeah, I know.
Number one. Hell of a singer. I was watching a couple of YouTube videos. Holy moly.
Oh, yeah.
And how did that come about? Like, did he ask you? Did you ask him?
Yeah.
How did that come about?
Yeah, that's really funny. So my wife and I, when we first moved to the Bay Area, you know, we came upon, you know, one of the booths at a street fair that was just advertising for Pacific Boy Choir is the name of it. And we just kind of signed him up early. And really tried not to like be the typical parents, oh, you know, pushing too hard. You know, we really just sort of tried to, you know, let him kind of, you know, gravitate to it. But having that foundation, and then when we would jam early on, I mean, I had a drum kit, a full size drum kit in his bedroom when he was still in the crib. So he's still in diapers.
How many pieces?
It was like a four piece.
Double kick?
Yeah, right, right. No, and what was amazing is we would do these jams where we both had like Who shirts, and I taught him how to sing, you know, "Won't Get Fooled Again," you know, classic Daltrey, and I'd get behind the drums, and that really was a catalyst to the rock and roll side. So just really fortunate, and it's unbelievable that he has this sort of pedigree, you know, and this experience with the boy choir, and really like learned a lot of voice control. It's amazing. Like the last few times I did a single, This Big Love, for my wife's birthday, I brought him in the studio, and my son's voice had changed at that time. And so we had to like, usually he's doing the high harmony and, you know, and I'm doing the low, and we switched, and it's just been like one of the most incredible experiences being a father, being a musician, and really trying to let it kind of evolve on its own. And so I've just been so fortunate to, you know, have him involved. And the cool thing is the next session, he just wrote this thing on piano, lyrics, vocal, melody line. And I'm like, you want some drums? And he's like, yeah. And I'd play him some beats, and he was like, I don't know, it's kind of sounding a little busy there. You know, what if we just, you know,
he's got notes.
Oh, it's incredible. It's incredible. So, you know, I'm really stoked about it. We're going to do that April 14th.
You know, you talk about playing, I mean, I know you're a big Keith Moon fan. Like, is it, you're playing Who songs in his room.
Yeah.
How much are you trying to like ride the gas and the brake with, you know, trying to get him to like what you like so you can like pal around together versus like, I want to let you decide. Yeah. Like, where are you at that?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it was pretty interesting. I think when he was in first and second grade, that there seemed to be a switch where I was, you know, trying to have as much, you know, diversity, but within the rock and roll, you know, rock element. Yeah. And then, he started to gravitate towards, you know, a little bit more, you know, pop, you know, dance pop and kind of more of a lot of what the kids, you know, but I would also within that genre, you know, what was that one band, Capital Cities, where that there's like, I actually teach some of the synth parts at the School of Rock for some of my keyboard students, you know, this super dance, you know, totally dance pop, but it's got really cool chords, you know? And so I think, you know, we would listen to a little bit of that. And, so yeah, that's a hard thing to navigate, you know, because one of the other musicians I work with has older kids in college now. And, he's more of a Sabbath, you know, Zeppelin guitarist and really just into that, you know, kind of music and, and really was, you know, trying to get his son into that. And I taught his son drums when he was just starting middle school and he wanted to learn Motorhead, Ace of Spades. And he couldn't play that fast, right? So I'm like slowing down this Motorhead song and, just went easy with it. But yeah, a couple years later, you know, his kid is not into that kind of music at all. Like he's just doing something else, you know, but I guess we can just introduce, you know, some inspirational.
You throw it out there and maybe some of it sticks.
You guys have kids? You guys?
We do.
Yeah. Nice. Both Jason and I do. Yeah.
Okay. So what are the ages with your kids there?
My daughters, I got a 9-year-old daughter and a 4-year-old son.
And I've got we're closing in on 7 and 3.
Ooh, nice. Yeah. Those are some interesting age gaps there.
Yeah.
Well, it's awesome. It's funny because like my daughter is big into music. And so she loves like, you know, she loves Pearl Jam. My son is obsessed with Pearl Jam right now, which is really cool.
Is he really?
That's great.
Yeah, he is. He's asking me to play it all the time. My daughter is really into Metallica right now.
Yeah.
She's a big fan of that. And it's funny, like she started asking me for Stabbing Westward, which was an industrial metal band from back in the early 90s, you know? And so, it's just a wide palette of.
That's very specific.
I know. Well, it's the stuff I'm playing in the background. She'll just hear it. She'll be like, who is that? What is that?
And, well, you know, it's interesting. When Pearl Jam played Ohana, you know, I brought the family down and that was Alexander's first time seeing Pearl Jam. And, you know, definitely like we don't really go to that many big shows, but that was a pretty epic one. And there was the band Lord Huron, one of the openers. Yep. And man, that, and I wasn't that familiar with that songwriter. You know, obviously heard about it, but never saw it. And we were both, my son and I were just really blown away. Like, you know, ended up getting a couple records and just really like you know, it's interesting when you can find things that you kind of resonate with.
And it was organic too, Rich. Yeah, like you just both found it in the moment.
Yeah. Yeah. We were both just like, I'm looking at him just like, God, can you believe the sound that this band is making? Yeah. And, you know, and then, you know, the Pearl Jam thing was great. It was just so like just intense and great. You know, atmosphere, and that was pretty special.
You know, we do want to take a minute here just because we're talking about that father son relationship. You know, just to take a moment to send our condolences to you in regards to your father.
Oh wow,
to hear of his passing a couple of months ago.
So. Yeah, appreciate that.
Now, speaking of your father, you released the last song in his honor.
Yeah.
Shortly after as a single on your Bandcamp.
Yeah.
It's a beautiful tune.
Oh, thank you.
We both Jason and I think there's just this wonderful dynamic between fathers and sons. We both experience it on a day-to-day basis. Obviously you do as well. And how that relationship evolved over decades.
Yeah.
And within that context, you have this great lyric in there, "Dad, you're going to live forever inside a dream you helped me find."
Yeah.
So if you're willing, could you take a minute, just like talk about your process for finding some peace through the creation of that song?
Yeah.
You know, what kind of a catharsis you found, maybe just your relationship with your dad through
that? Yeah. I mean, that is a really interesting line, you know, because I think something about writing a song cathartically, you know, after losing my father, I feel like, because he was so supportive and just like really just sincerely interested in everything I was doing musically, you know, it was almost like maybe a gift, you know, in his honor. But the other trippy thing that I need to realize is that, because I think in the song, I'm also saying, hey, when you leave, you know, part of me is going to leave. And I know certain lyrics can have that cliche sort of element, but I really felt that. I really felt like, and it's strange because I think, you know, my father and I had, you know, somewhat of a distant relationship, you know, right around the high school, early college years. But then over time, you know, we really kind of rebonded, and he was always like, "Hey, what's your latest? What are your latest tunes?" So I would send my dad all the way back from, like, you know, when Three Fish first started demoing. I would just give. I gave my dad. My dad has all the side projects, like rough mixes, early versions of songs, because I really felt that, you know, he would listen, you know, he just loved listening to music and painting. And so I think it was also a way, you know, for me to feel like I had some validation, you know? And so within that validation, there might be a kind of ego element. And I think that's something that songwriters, you know, I think all of us, I mean, I'll speak for myself, but, you know, there is something about the process where, you know, you're writing something, you want it to mean something to your listeners and your supporters and the people you love. But, you know, it's kind of this weird, you know, I don't want to say myopic or even narcissistic element, but loving the process of songwriting and putting it out there, I think is also a way of like kind of being okay with yourself. Like if you have some self-doubt or you maybe have some elements of shame or just some things that you could have done better in your life, well, you know, there's a good reason that maybe, you know, songwriting can also heal the actual writer, you know, as well as maybe move people that
it's
are
therapeutic
in
for you.
Oh, right? Totally. You know,
and if you're writing a song that has a very special connection, obviously this one does.
Yeah.
It's kind of like a bonus multiplier if someone else finds the connection as well.
Yeah. Right.
And isn't that the ultimate goal, is to have that double, that multiplier of connections?
Well, you know how, like with the Pearl Jam circle, you know, there's a lot of support and people, you know, communicate.
Yeah.
And I'm really like appreciative of like Pearl Jam fans that have really opened up, you know, to maybe my involvement on the outer peripheral elements and you know, with my own writing. But this one woman just responded like, she went through the same thing with a family member. And she was just like, the second I, you know, got halfway through the song, like I'm just in tears, you know, like, wow, you know, it's pretty heavy.
It is heavy, man.
Well, but let's move into some happier.
Yeah, there we go.
well, you mentioned Tim DeJulia earlier, and you mentioned Barrett Jones earlier on this new record. And I mean, you posted a clip of the album closer, Memory Can Weigh a Ton, and Tim sounds massive.
Oh, yeah.
That clip sounds awesome.
Yeah.
And then Barrett Jones, absolute legend, done so many great records. Like, how, describe those relationships and how they came together in this nexus of jam. Up in Seattle.
Yeah. You know, so I met Barrett probably early 90s. I was in a band called Pilot with one of the members.
Was it spelled P-I-L-A-T-E?
No, it's funny. This guy, Jeremy, he was in a band called the Dharma Bums, you know, and from Portland. And so he started this band, Pilot. And right around that time, I also met Tim. That was in Lazy Susan. But with the connection with Barrett and Pilot, Barrett kind of brought Pilot on the road to back him doing like a little solo thing. And he had already the record for the first Foo Fighter record.
Right.
So that was already kind of coalescing. And so Barrett's just like, he's amazing in the studio and amazing live too, but always just like some great ideas. And matter of fact, he kind of had some ideas in this last session with Tim on this particular song. And
has he pushed you to like, to have you thought you had a song on this record? And he's like, nah, you can do this thing. Has he pushed you in certain instances?
You know, I think a lot of, you know, what I think like with Barrett and even the engineer that worked on this last record, sort of kind of hands off and have really cool ideas, kind of, you know. Also, it's like what I call ear candy, you know, like extra overdubs or just like alternating the part. And that's one thing I always am just so like incredibly grateful to be able to have all these musicians come in, like, you know, learn some parts. And I have to tell this to Ryan at some point. You know, there were a couple moments on this record.
Ryan Lent, recognize what we're talking about.
And I actually wrote a couple of the guitar solos in some of the songs on this latest one that I had these amazing guest guitarists. And I really felt like, okay, I want to let them do their thing, because that is kind of really getting into the details of producing every move. But what was interesting, I would let, you know, guitarists kind of, you know, find their, you know, their groove. But then I think my own kind of like power pop sensibility, all of a sudden I would just kind of come up with a melody. It's probably just like a vocal, cool, catchy vocal melody. Mm-hmm. And then some of the solos would just sort of have this really like hook element. And I'm so lucky because, you know, Kurt Block, you know, laid a cool solo down, and Tim. And what was funny with Tim in the studio with Barrett, we have like multiple layers, you know, that we could draw from, and I was letting Tim do his thing. But then there was this thing like, oh, hey, could you kind of do that thing again? And then maybe repeat it another four times. And then Barrett would come in with, actually, can you just change a couple of notes in within that melody? And then I would go, hey, actually do that like four more times. And so,
notes on notes on notes.
Yeah. And, you know, I've been doing this long enough to where I think I've been able to decipher the difference between the idea of, because when sometimes you get a band dynamic and someone will have an idea, but then what happens is that opens the door for the rest of the band to go, oh, okay, well, so now we're sharing ideas. And then what happens, that's where a band that has the healthiest communication will get through this thing I'm talking about. And it's okay if it's not that healthy, but what ends up happening is all of a sudden someone will have an idea, someone else has an idea on that, and will almost like unconsciously come in a little too early so that the original idea doesn't really get a chance to develop. And so that's a real fragile thing that happens. And I think it really happens in the studio because, you know, you don't want to be rushed for time, but there are moments where it's like, okay, we don't want to spend too much time.
Right.
And, but that thing with Tim and Barrett for this particular outro on the album Closer, was just really, really cool because it was just like everybody's kind of respecting each other and just, you know, trying to make it happen, you know, for the sake of the song, you right. know.
There is a moment of possibly too many cooks in the kitchen, but at the same time,
totally.
It's your record.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
You can be like, guys, I liked that idea over there. Let's just go with
that. Yeah, exactly. I mean, where things got interesting with one of the R&DM, the second R&DM record, that was interesting because there was a dynamic. Jeff and Joseph, you know, would sort through elements of, you know, production and how we would, you know, treat each song. And, you know, and sometimes there's just going to be moments where there's just differences about, you know, okay, there's no more paint we can add to this canvas, you know, and that's a hard thing for not only a person to do as a songwriter, but like you start adding more people to that mix. It's like, how do you even get to a collective idea? Okay, this thing is.
I always ask people whenever we have an artist on the show, I go, "How do you know when a song is done?"
Yeah, yeah, no,
because it's so subjective. I mean, how many more overdubs? How many more overdubs?
Yeah, not to geek out on this, but I have this theory with subjective and objective reality. So when you're in a studio tracking with your particular instrument and you're trying to gel, if you're cutting live or just doing an overdub. But what's interesting is that is the moment where it's just like your objective reality. And it's only when you go into the control room and listen to the playback, that's the subjective element. Because, you know, and when you get older, Jeff and I talked about this too. You get to a process where you could actually be in the room and work and just know that, no, this isn't, don't do that, you know, and it's just amazing when you can do it on the spot. So you don't have to like cut a take, go into the control room and go, okay, no, don't do that. Then if you can eliminate that subjective and objective dynamic, you know, that's where things start to get really interesting. And I feel like I'm really lucky as a drummer. And I've heard other drummers mention to me, you know, like, hey, the fact that you kind of like songwriter allows you to really like, you know, not overanalyze drum parts, but just really like kind of that play for the song, you know, as cliche as that sounds, you know. Mm-hmm.
Sorry about that. So for our listeners who are actually watching, I literally disappeared off the screen for a bit. Those listening could care less because I didn't even know I was gone. But those watching obviously did notice. And the reason that I had to depart was my four-year-old was having a disagreement with the Sandman, apparently.
Oh, wow.
I was called in to help arbitrate that disagreement, but
oh my God, that's hilarious.
I am curious, just kind of like a segue into what you were just talking about though, Richard. Mm-hmm. Let's go to May of 2022. So Matt Cameron comes down with COVID. It's been a couple of years now. You know, you've told our friends over at the Wishlist Foundation that the whole thing happened literally in like 24 hours. But looking back on that timeline, from Jeff texting you to rehearsing with the guys, playing all those three shows, you know, what do you look back at as being profound about sitting in for Matt? Obviously, besides playing a Who song, right? Like Bob O'Reilly, sold out arena.
There it is. For those of you listening only,
it's right
there. You're just pointing to a photo.
Yeah, a good friend of mine framed this image of night one doing Bob O'Reilly.
That's it.
And it's just this epic pic where, you know, Mike's like this, Eddie's catching air. And the greatest thing about that experience was Mike coming up to the drum riser and going, you know, Keith Moon the shit out of this. And I'm like, oh, I will. And
I will do that.
And, I will.
And you know, the funny thing is, I can't even describe the adrenaline. Like, it's, I mean, I've played, you know, I've done a couple of tours where, you know, supporting act and, you know, played some large theaters and, you know, arenas. But nothing like that. I mean, even as a guest drummer, and that was just something really special. It's bizarre. I mean, the timing is pretty bizarre. I was on my way to the School of Rock, and one of my students, like the week before, I taught him Why Go, you know, because we actually had the School of Rock. We actually had a grunge group that I directed, and I'm literally like, you know, working with this kid, and I get the call, and it's like, they're going to send a car. I'm going to go down to the arena to rehearse. It's all surreal. It's all happening. And I just tell this kid, I gotta go. Why go? No. it was pretty intense, you know.
What number of songs did you already have in your back pocket versus how many you had to kind of like?
Yeah, you know, I think a lot of that stuff too is muscle memory. Even with like Jeremy, I got so excited performing Jeremy that I actually forgot that Jeff finishes that with that iconic bass line.
Yeah.
And it was just one of those things where, yeah, I felt so comfortable because those guys are really incredible. It's like family. And when it comes down to really just being in the same room and, you know, sharing the stage. And yeah, I just, you know, like anyone else, you know, you want to do well, you want to just bring it. And yeah, it was just like a couple, I noticed it on the bootleg. It was just like, you know, it was like just one short little extra bar of a fill. And I'm like, and then Jeff's looking at me, Ed looked back, they're both smiling, you know, like, oh, this is pretty funny.
They knew.
Like, yeah. It was pretty. So.
Well, you played the shit out of WMA, and that's a song that we rarely get.
Oh, yeah.
I have to know, did you bring that? Do you like, I think we should play this song.
Okay,
how did that happen?
You know what's interesting about that?
Because it was awesome, by the way.
I really feel that I probably...
Thank you for that.
Thank you. I should have mentioned something to Ed because I was talking to Klinghoffer as we were... Because what we would do in the green room, we would, you know, just get ready, you know, where everybody's comfortable, you know, and then we'd go to the doorway of the green room and get escorted to the stage. And there was this really great moment where I decided to wear this tough skin jacket, and it's like 70s, and we're all standing there, and then Eddie looks over, he's like, is that a tough skin? I go, yeah, it's kind of comfy. And then Mike's, I had a pair of jeans. I had a pair of tough skin jeans. And then someone else mentioned, you know, I think I had a pair of shoes. And so it was just this like really surreal moment, like a minute before going on stage, you know, getting escorted. We were talking about, you know, this, you know, tough
waxing nostalgia on Tuscan.
Yeah. But it was that moment, that moment, because we were doing that song that night. And I could have like, hey, Eddie, I was just kind of thinking Josh and I were going to just jam it out. I'm sure he would have been fine, but I don't know if I just maybe like kept it an element of surprise. So that song is just really, I was even asking the guys, like, how do you want to end it? Nobody really kind of knew.
Well, it was 9 minutes long, so apparently no. You decided.
Oh, God, that's really overindulgent, isn't it? Well, you know, when I mentioned it to Klinghoffer, he was like, yeah, I'm down for that. And so there was just this kind of exchange. But in the footage, though, you kind of see Eddie like, okay, what are these guys doing? You know, like, not that it was a bad thing, but it was pretty interesting.
I was grooving at home, Rich.
So right on. Yeah. I mean, maybe that was where, you know, the idea is to feel as comfortable as possible, and then, but also to keep it in control, you know, but Yeah, it was, God, it was a blast, you know. And some of my conversations with Jeff after each show, you know, it was pretty interesting. I'm like, hey, man, I hope I didn't like overplay. He's like, oh, man, you killed it, you know. So, you know.
You've said, Richard, that Matt's drum tech was just really, really kind.
Oh, yeah.
To you at that time.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, Matt had reached out and basically said that I could use this Yamaha kit if I wanted or if I wanted to bring something. And I'd recently purchased that Vistalite kit. So I just thought, like, you know, that might look kind of cool and sound cool. And it was pretty bold. I talked to a couple other fans. They were like, okay, something's up, man. That's not Matt's.
As soon as they revealed the drums
what's going on here? Yeah. But, you know, Cruisin' and Josh were, you know, they're like, yeah, these are fun to play, you know. So that felt like a pretty natural, you know, way to roll. What a bizarre circumstance, though, you know, because I started to think about things like, you know, COVID, right? So it's a horrifying thing that we went through on varying degrees, but it's like, I don't know, it was just kind of a interesting way to get a call, you know. But it was killer to step in and just have fun with it, you know.
Did you, you know, unfortunately that happened again with Matt last fall, where they had to cancel an Indianapolis show and then they went ahead with a show in Fort Worth. Josh played the whole show.
Yeah.
But you were thinking pre-show, like, did you get a call again?
Yeah. That would have been kind of cool. But yeah, maybe they were just trying to keep it, like, you know, a little more just straight up,
contained.
You know. And Josh is a great drummer, you know, great, great feel. So I really wanted to play Corduroy, though. That's pretty much my favorite tune. But Nothing Man was probably the highlight outside of Mike over here telling me to Keith Moon the shit out of the tune.
Well, let's go there.
Yeah.
Let's talk about it, man. Let's go all the way back. Richard Stuver.
Yeah.
1994.
Yeah.
Nothing Man demo, right?
Yeah.
Eddie said that, you know, left the studio that night, blasting the demo in his car, driving through Seattle, singing it. Walk us through those sessions.
It was amazing. Well, you know, a lot of times Jeff would just call, like, hey, you want to come down, you know, and this was that Triangle Reciprocal, which Bleach was recorded there.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, just so much, you know, Northwest iconic recordings. But Jeff just called up, hey, I'm just demoing some tunes. You want to come down? And cool. Everything's set up. We start going through a couple numbers, and then Ed walks in, and he didn't say he was going to be there. And so, you know, and he brought his typewriter, a yellow legal pad, and just, hey, Rich, you know, oh, man, nice, good to see you. And I'll never forget, you know, Jeff had the riff for Nothing Man, and Ed just was in the corner, you know. It was kind of this poetic moment, too, because it was like this old, you know, antique lamp, you know, that typewriter and just sitting, you know, and just typing a little bit, but then writing while we were playing. It was really kind of like a Bob Dylan moment. Like, it just kind of felt that way to me. Like, this guy is like freaking amazing, man. And like, so he's cooking up something. And then we kind of have the arrangement and then we got enough isolation in a real organic way. So it just really felt comfortable. And all of a sudden we're going and it's first take and he's singing that. And I'm just like, are you fucking kidding me? I don't know. Friggin' kidding me. Sorry. You know,
we curse all the time.
Okay. Hell yeah. No, it was just like, I was doing that 3/4 time and I was so blown away at the tonality of his voice, the melody, and then what I could gather, you know, the lyrics, like the downbeat thing about 3/4 is the down. You want that.
It's heavy.
Yeah.
Well, you want, but you know, a lot of times guitar players, you know, they also need to kind of match if they're in the same kind of realm of rhythm, you know. Not, you know, it doesn't always have to be just like, but even if they're strumming, they got it, you know, it needs to lock in, right? And once I heard his vocal, it was so, I was kind of off. It wasn't Jeff. It was, I was just like, maybe rushed a beat or, you know, was back. I notice it when they re-release the box set, you know, they put the demo on there.
The demo was there.
Yeah. Did that surprise you, by the way, when they re-released that and your version came out?
Well, you know, what was interesting was, you know, Jeff was telling me that Brennan O'Brien, they weren't even really considering that song seriously. Like, it was just, you know, one of many. And when Brennan O'Brien heard it, he was like, okay, you guys need to put that on the album. And they were like, well,
good call.
Yeah. And so they worked it up, and it was really cool to hear, you know, that version, you know. Yeah. It's cool to hear, you know, demos and what finally comes around, you know, as the final. It's really, really interesting. I'm reading a book right now called The Anatomy of a Song, and it's just fascinating. I'm just rereading every chapter. It just talks about these moments where the songwriter, producer, you know, are going through these experiences with these iconic songs, you know. But this song really resonated with me, just being, you know, in that moment, you know, and space and time. And I remember Kelly Curtis at one point was like, you know, I don't know if it was when Dave was out of the band or not, but I go, man, it was really cool to, I know what it was. It was like when they, you know, released that box set, you know, I was in touch with the organization on that. And Kelly was like, hey man, you know, Eddie kind of liked your version better than the final thing, you know, which that was a nice thing to say, you know.
Yeah.
But, you know, not to go too much into that, but a lot of that could also be where, you know, how, like, I don't know how you guys feel, but like there's something raw about, you know, one of the early evolution of the song. And not to always go, okay, now it's just like overproduced or it's, you know, this big production thing, but sometimes
You're playing, Richard, like that was part of the genesis of his lyrical composition.
Oh,
the
whole composition
came together, you know what I mean?
Right,
so like
right.
He was drawing from you and from Jeff when he was writing those lyrics.
Right. So. Yeah, and then to do that live, I mean, you know, he had that kind of long introduction, but it's going to sound really cheesy, but for many years, I always thought, like, I got to get up on stage with this band at some point. It was weird. Like, I don't even know where, I mean, I'm just sharing really loose and random thought, but you know how that happens. You know, you're just like,
it took a global pandemic for that to happen.
Oh my God.
Mother Nature said, hold on, everybody. God. Hold on, society. Yeah. Hold on, economics.
Oh, that's amazing.
We need Rich to play on this song.
Yeah. But, you know, that was the thing where, you know, Jeff's sitting down, you know, looking over and just smiling about the story. And then just gave me the look like, okay, here we go. And it was just a beautiful moment that I like to call it what Wim Wenders calls suspended animation. Mm. You know, that's what it was.
Richard, talk to me about, you know, we've been kind of circling around your relationship with Jeff the entire episode. And I think a lot of Pearl Jam fans, music fans recognize that relationship is special.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, we don't need to go into the origin story. Obviously, back in the 80s, Seattle.
Yeah.
You guys met, you know, crossed paths a lot. What has he meant to you as a friend and as a musician?
Yeah, it's great. I mean, we do go back. I mean, the Fastbacks rehearsed in the same area, the Ground Zero Art Gallery in this beat up part of Seattle. Yeah, it was really interesting. When we started kind of, we lived pretty close to each other in the Seattle Center area. And, you know, at one point when I was in the War Babies and Mother Love Bone was, you know, kind of really like starting to become something, that's when our friendship really kind of started to go, you know, a little beyond the acquaintance, you know. And when War Babies had him as a, had Jeff as a interim bass player, you know, he played a couple of shows with us. And I think that's when I just realized sort of what I spoke about earlier about, like, he'd come in with these like funk jams and, you know, these like rocker guys, but then like really getting into this, you know, more diverse, you know, experience. But that was when I think he just really respected me as a drummer. And then, you know, the reciprocal like bass action. And, you know, I was really hoping he could like maybe stick it out with War Babies, but, you know, but then, you know, history kind of unravels. And I think the friendship and musical respect is really interesting because I think Jeff, you know, he's somewhat of a reclusive guy. He's really motivated and has like, so he's so creative in everything he does, even outside music, you know? And I think that was all kind of like part of his personal evolution. But I think it was also like his way of kind of, I don't know, like giving back in a way, like, cause you know, all the guys have like tight friends that, you know, they'll collaborate with, you know. And I think, you know, early on the Three Fish idea was when things really started to gel. And that was just really a cool moment. And I think that was Jeff's ability to, you know, I'd always refer to him as like an alchemist of sorts where, you know, and he had these desires too, to stretch out. Because I think all the guys in the band, by being able to stretch outside of the band, you know, they can bring those experiences back in. And I think, you know, when you look at the history of Pearl Jam, you know, there were some bumps in the road, you know, and going through a lot of drummers. So and the whole Ticketmaster thing. So, you know, it's pretty endless there. But so I think like the side project thing was important for them. And I think it was important for Jeff. And what I found from our friendship and musical respect really kind of evolved in this, hey, I have this platform, I have this success, and I want to bring some of my friends and other musicians that I respect, you know, I want to make records, I want to make art with them, you know. And I think like, and you know, he did a lot, man. He really stepped up, and I for one, you know, super grateful to be, just have that opportunity, you know, and then when he would bring me in to do some of his solo records, you know, mm-hmm. that was super cool. And then I started to, you know, it's really interesting. It's like, almost like a symbiotic element where as soon as I started getting really into my own recording and trying to collaborate, I started to think along the same lines. And so, you know, that's where I'd try and get him in on some of my stuff. And not this last January, but the January before, Jeff found the studio in San Diego. And I was just assuming maybe it was for another solo record, or, you know, he also will record with me and then bring some of those ideas into the band to mm-hmm. see what, you know. And so that's all been, you know, really cool. But we really gelled in San Diego. I mean, it was like 10 songs in 2 days, like just, you know.
Is this, what was this for? Is this for the your new record or?
Well, when I congratulated him on Dark Matter, he said, hey, you know, when it drops, when you get your copy, listen for it. You might hear some familiar things. So that might be kind of funny. Pardon me. You know, cause it was just so rad. I mean, so comfortable with him, and just, it was just bass, drums, or you'd go to guitar, and it was just like we'd been playing together for so long in these projects that everything just gelled so quickly. And so when I put the finishing touches on my next record last November, you know, he was available. Jeff was available to come in for two songs, and so I was all like, it was at the same studio. So it was like he was all like, "Oh wow, cool! You like the studio? Like the drums are killer. I mean, the drums are amazing." And so, yeah, that was really special. He was just like, "Just finished the artwork for Pearl Jam's latest," and he's like, "Man, I got to be in Seattle to finish this thing, but I'm really kind of like, I need to get back to San Diego." And I'm like, "Well, I'm going to leave the door open for you. And I really hope you can make it." And man, it was amazing. He had 2 hours. It was killer. 2 hours, two songs tracked.
Bang.
We tracked it live. And my buddy Neil, you know, who lives in West Hills, was just, I'm making eye contact with him. Jeff's got his station, headphones are on. And my buddy Neil is just looking at me like, "Oh my God, it's fucking amazing." You know, and Jeff's smiling, and we, oh God. Yeah, but both songs in two takes, you know, and I'm going to put the opening track on the album and the second track. I just like these two songs with Jeff on it, just right out of the gates.
I was going to ask you because he has two credits on this upcoming record.
Yeah, yeah.
So there they are.
Boom.
Beautiful.
Yeah. Let's do it.
Well, hey, you know, speaking of doing it, I'm in San Diego. So the next time you guys together in San Diego, how about we do some tea and French toast?
Hell yeah. That, huh? Hell yeah.
Are we getting another single before the record comes out?
Maybe digitally should do that.
And when is the album coming out, by the way?
October. Yeah. I know.
Man, I gotta wait that long.
Did we do this too early?
No. We come back and do it again.
Yeah. I know.
We get a copy and then we go track by track.
Oh, that'd be cool. That'd be great. Yeah. See? I just wanted to, you know, it was a really long process, you know, finishing it. And then I just started thinking, I don't know, summer release. I don't know. People are vacation, just festivals and stuff. Like,
it's a hot Stuverud summer. Come on now.
Yeah. Right. I know. But I got something at Easy Street up in Seattle. I'm going to get that going again. They're really cool.
Well, we're talking to Matt Vaughn very soon.
Yeah, nice. Oh, he's the best. When I played there last March, the March before, I'm like, "Hey, man, thank you for having me, man. I'm just, you know, trying to keep it humble, you know, and I'm so lucky to have all these, you know, killer musicians, you know, playing with." And Matt just looked over. He's like, "Hey man, this is your night. Have fun, you know." Just like super supportive.
Very cool. Let's end this on a fun note. Can we end it on a fun note?
Absolutely.
Here? All right, you ready?
Yeah.
What is the ultimate Keith Moon song?
The ultimate Keith Moon song. There's so many, but I'm gonna have to go with "Won't Get Fooled Again." Only because I saw it when I was a kid in the theater, and you know, when the kids are all right, that there's 10 seconds, Roger Daltrey scream and just the drums coming back in and that just classic rock, you know. But I mean, you know, "Substitute" is killer. "Pictures of Lily," a quick one. Just like.
What do you think is the most underrated Who song?
Oh, that's a good one.
Ooh. For me, it's "Eminence Front."
Oh, interesting. Yeah.
10th album, 1982.
Yeah. Or 3, like, oh, that's really good.
It's a Townsend song, right?
It's such a cool groove. It's nobody ever talks about it. I love that song.
That's really
Pete
good.
Pete Townsend, front and center.
I know. I'm going to have to give that one some thought. But now you've inspired me, so tomorrow I'm just going to, you know, I'm gonna do what's up there, you know.
There you go.
Yeah.
Go bring your piano and your drums back out into the garden.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Get a drone going.
Yeah. There you go. Yeah. Got to keep it interesting, right? It's really super cool talking to you guys, man.
Oh man, it's been a blast.
It's been a pleasure,
and
Richard.
I'm glad we were able to get you on here and chat.
A lot of caffeine in this tea, you know. So I hope I didn't blab on too much over here.
Not at all. They'd rather hear you than us, trust me.
Nice.
Well,
nice.
we'll have you back when the record comes out.
Yeah,
we'll
yeah.
Track by track.
Oh, that's a really cool idea. I'd love to do that. You know,
fantastic.
Excellent. So and amazing questions. And you guys are great. So,
well, thank you.
This thing is a cool thing.
Hat tip to Jason on that.
Yeah. Awesome, yeah. Man. Cool, well, you guys.
Thank you again. And guys, it's Richard Stuverud.
Rock and roll. Thanks for having me. Right.
All right. Another big thanks to Richard Stuverud for drinking tea with us and having a great time. And I look forward to chatting in the fall with his next record, Paul.
I can't wait. Song by song, a little deconstruction with Richard Stuverud.
Oh, yeah. If you liked that episode and let that chat with Richard, go ahead and subscribe. Like the video.
You should do that.
Maybe hit the bell. Bing, 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 bing. That would be super. That would help us out. That would help the community out. And that's what it's all about, Paul.
It is. It's about community. And honestly, it's my favorite part about this entire process. We love having an opportunity to connect with everybody. It's not just an opportunity to connect with the folks that we interview. It's an opportunity to connect, especially on Patreon. I mean, there is just a great community that is being built there. And I'm very grateful for that community. And it's sometimes it's a treat just to watch the conversations. It really is.
Mm-hmm.
And just to see the love and just to see the camaraderie. And honestly, like there's some real deep dives into everything from Brad Clausen's posters. We have a great competition, a little March Madness with Clausen posters. Are you kidding me?
Yeah, the number one is about to be revealed. I know. At the time of taping, it hasn't been
voted?
Revealed quite
voted.
Yet.
I voted.
Yes.
Our top four.
Our Discord gets wild, guys. If you're interested in Patreon, another thing. The Discord goes crazy. I came back to like 100 messages today. I go, what is going on over there? But it's a good community within the community. And all are welcome. By the way, like I said, top of the show, if you want to write a review, Paul, what are they doing to get this bad boy?
Well, they don't have to rip the cellophane off that. That's for sure. No. That is a beautiful mojo. Well, you did. Exactly. But Paul's not eligible for this one, but you are.
Incorrect.
So go ahead and rate, review, and subscribe on your preferred podcast platform of choice. Most importantly, write a review because we're going to pick one of those bad boys. And that is going to be your ticket to that lovely magazine right there. Mojo article with Pearl Jam. With the accompanying CD.
That's right. Nothing left to say, but thanks for stopping
yes.
by.
Absolutely. You know?
And we're coming back next week. And next week, we are talking with, I mentioned it in the interview, Matt Vaughn, owner of Easy Street Records. Very excited to have him on, talking
absolutely.
Vinyl, talking
live
record
at Easy
store
Street
day.
With Matt Vaughn.
That's right. And we're just days away. We'll be days away from the drop of Pearl Jam's Dark Matter a day before Record Store Day. Maybe we'll talk 12 variants, Paul, and what that means.
Oh, gosh. Pun intended.
This is how we go viral. We talk about the 12 variants.
This
anyways, that's next week. And we'll see you there. And until we do, you've been listening to and watching.
Oh, you caught me off guard there.
Sorry.
The State of Love and Trust.